don't care what you do, don't leave that hospital without a blood test. So he's like, okay, fine, I'll try. So he goes and he requests for a blood test. He gets a blood test. And so he calls us back and he says, they said the results will be ready in 2 hours. And so, well, okay, we're just talking to him. And then he sees his phone ringing and it had said emergency room. So he's like, my phone is saying emergency room. So my mom is like, pick it, pick it. So he picks it while we're still online and he's like, hello. And then we can overhear, you know, they're like, Mr. Wako, is that you? And he's like, yes. Can you kindly come back to the hospital? He's like, okay, sure. Then they're like, do you have someone to drive you? He's like, yeah, my neighbor. Okay. And then my mom, she's like, I would just ask the nurse what your blood count is, your HB. And then he's like, what's my blood count? So she says four. And then my mom's like, okay, we'll call you, okay? It's like, okay, I'll see you. Then he logs out. My mom just takes a deep breath.
Starts praying.
She starts praying. So we don't hear from my brother. So, you know, he's like, okay, I'll let you guys know when I'm at the hospital, what happens, and he hangs up. And so my mom, she just sits there, you know, and she just takes a deep breath, and she just, you know, starts to pray. And, you know, I'm looking at her, and I'm like, okay, it's not okay. But, you know, she wasn't, you know, overreacting or anything, so I didn't think much of it, you know, and I didn't ask what's normal. So now that night, we're waiting on my brother to call us. He's not calling us back. We can't reach him. His phones are off. And I'm waiting for his neighbor was a friend of mine. Actually, the one who took him to the hospital was one of my sorority sisters.
Okay.
And I get a call from our friend Sandra. She's Kenyan as well. And she also goes to the same school. And you know those calls that come in at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., you just know.
That's M night.
It's not good. And so she picks up and I'm like, hey. And she's like, hey. And I could just hear in her voice. She's like, it's your brother. And I'm like, what? Where are you? And she says, I'm at the hospital. He's here. He didn't want me to call you. But I have to. I have to let you know what's happening. And I'm like, just tell me, just tell me. We'll deal with him later. Just tell me what's going on. And she's like, your brother was in ICU. He just had 7 blood transfusions. He's stable now. But they're saying that his kidneys are gone. And interestingly, at that same moment, my brother, my older brother, is in US for a meeting in Georgia. So about 2 hours away. And now I'm the one who's received the news first. I'm living with my parents and my sister, my older sister, and I don't know who to tell first. So somehow it doesn't hit me, or maybe I don't know. I seem to take it. And I say, thanks for telling me. I appreciate that. And I hang up. And I pass my parents' room and I go to my sister's room because I think she's the older one. Maybe she's the one who needs to break it to our parents. And so I go to her room and, you know, I wake her up and I'm like, hey, I just got a call. Job's not okay. He's in ICU. I didn't even finish. He's just received my sister. She starts crying and she immediately calls my older brother. They are close. She now dials him and puts him on speaker. You need to go to hospital. And she's crying. And my older brother is like, what's going on? I don't understand. What hospital? Where are we going? So now she's crying and talking to my older brother. I'm like, huh? I better go tell my parents. Because now they're going to wonder what's all this commotion. So I go to their room and, you know, I knock and I try to just take a deep breath. And now is when now the tears are beginning to fall down my face. And, you know, I go to my mom's bedside and just tap her. And, you know, she sits up. And I say, you know, mom, Sandra just called. You know, this is what's happening with Joab. He's had 7 blood transfusions. They've stabilized him. then as soon as I've given her that report, now I start to cry. So my mom, she just sits up. She just says, okay, we need to pray and you need to be strong. So me, I'm crying, and she walks up and she begins to pray, and I could just hear my dad. Now he's sat up and he's just like, what is this? And long story short, my mom, you know, she left for the US almost immediately, and my brother, he got there, and you know, now the doctor comes and explains to us or to him. Luckily, my older brother was there, that, you know, we don't know what has happened to you. Honestly, we don't understand it. It's a miracle. In fact, they were calling him a miracle. Joab, when he walked into that hospital, he walked into the hospital and he walked to the reception. And the receptionist is like, can I help you? And he says, hi, I'm Mr. Wako. You called me. She just looked up. You're Mr. Wako? And he's like, yes. And she just hit an alarm. And he says every nurse and doctor in that hospital came running toward him. Didn't even explain this is an emergency case. Threw him on a bed, just asked for consent. Sir, allow us. And he's just like, okay. And they rushed him into the ICU immediately. And I think the doctors were surprised that he was walking, that he was alive. And the doctors said if he went to bed that night, he would have died in his sleep. That was how severe it was. And while they're plugging all these machines, he's seeing all these things being plugged, and he's looking at everybody and trying to wait for an explanation. They're like, can you hear us? Can you see us? He's like, yeah, I can hear, I can see. What's your name? He's saying his name, my family, it's in Kenya. They are wondering, how is this man, you know, talking to us, breathing, living? He should be dead. Mm-hmm. So my brother ended up earning the nickname Superman in the hospital. Mm. Because everyone was wondering how is he alive and functioning. And that was also, for me, I dropped everything. Siasa Place, we're in the middle of registering it. I'm still going back and forth with the NGO board. Mm. And when I saw that happening to my brother, because he's 25 at the time, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, he exercises, so very healthy. Mm. And so I just said, I need to go to the US to see my brother. Mm. And so my mother went before me and my dad as well, and then I joined them. And so at this point, I didn't even care.
What is happening with everything else?
I didn't care.
2015, yeah?
Yeah, 2015. Mm. And so we had a conversation now with my other siblings when it came to donation, because we were given options. We were told, he can be on the waiting list, but in the US at his age, he'll have to be on dialysis for 7 years, or one of you can donate to your brother. And, you know, we can check if your kidneys are healthy enough. If you match, we do it. So, of course, after having, we didn't want our parents to influence who decides. And also my parents were above the age of donating. So none of them, they were both crossed out. My father was above. My mother has conditions that don't allow her to. So it left me and my sister and my brother. Mm. So we sat down in a private meeting. We talked, we shared. And in the end, I said, I will do it. Mm. I will do it. And so I'm the one now who went to the US. I went through numerous tests. There are about 20 tests by the time they tell you, okay, you're good to go. So we reached the end where I was told you're good to go. Unfortunately, they found like, you know, we're all injected this injection.
BCG.
Yeah, BCG. Mm. So they found the BCG dead virus from the vaccine in my system.
From whatever years back?
Yes. Now, this is an issue because my brother's blood is not his blood. My brother got 7 transfusions.
Right.
So he's carrying the blood
of seven
other people who have never been to Africa. Who have never been. And so if I was to give him my organ, they were afraid that this dead cell could wake up and kill him. So receiving that news, we were like, what does this
even mean?
And so we talked to a few doctors, a few relatives, because there was the option of me going through treatment to clean it out of my system, the option of him going through treatment. And we're like, no, that it's a very intensive treatment. Apparently there are people who have died going through that treatment. So we're like, we're already at a risk. Why would we put ourselves there again? So we decide to leave the US, because initially we were going to do the surgery in the US. And my mom is like, let's go to India. Let's hear another opinion.
Mm.
So come to Kenya briefly.
We're with in your India. Well?
Yeah, my brother.
Mm.
And at this point now, the family, you know, is fundraising and helping us fundraise, because we've used a lot of resources in the US.
Mm.
Now we need to go to India. And so we now go to India. And I go through the same tests
again,
about 20 of them. And then now I get to the last test, which is DNA. Now, DNA. My brother and I, they look at about 6 different kinds of, I think they call them antigens.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really like a good match is when the 6 match. Mm. That's perfect.
Mm.
But most people don't get perfect.
Mm.
They'll get 3 out of 6, 4. I had 1 out of 6. And so it was like, even our DNA, it's like we are not related. So it's like I had my granddad from my dad and he had his grandmom from my mom. Like we are looking like strangers. So the doctor was like, wow, this is fascinating, but that's genetics, where you can have a family member and their genetics is like a stranger.
Mm.
I can match more with a stranger than my own.
Than your own blood, yeah.
Yeah, your own blood.
Mm.
So it was very interesting to see that, because my mother ended up having to do a DNA test.
Herself.
To prove to the doctors and the Indian government that I am their mother. And she is our mother. And there's also a whole process of lawyers and oaths and affidavits that I am not selling my kidney. And also the fact that I went, before I was married, I was dating now my husband.
At that time, 2015.
Yeah. Mm. And to have a doctor ask me, has your husband given you permission to do this? Like, this is my body and I'm not even married, thank goodness, because if I was,
it's another story.
I would need permission
from him.
Written. To give my kidney. But
that's international law, like it's stupid.
Man, I couldn't believe it.
Hmm.
I couldn't believe it. And so we're here now at the final stages. Now my dad and mom were all in India.
Hmm.
And the process, we ended up living in India for 3 months. The process took longer than expected because we were there when Prime Minister Modi changed the currency.
Hmm.
That was a whole other mess.
The cobwebs in your story, Nrima, my goodness.
Government affects my life.
Everything.
That's why I'm so passionate.
Systems, yeah.
So he wakes up one day at midnight and says, these currencies are now illegal. They will no longer be used.
Mm.
Every Indian citizen needs to now get the new currency.
Mm.
And sort of what they were trying to do in Kenya when they changed the currencies.
Mm. Mm.
And so people had to declare and take them back. That's the same thing.
Mm.
But the way India did it, Kenya, we had an idea.
Mm.
India, it happened pop.
Overnight.
Mm. So you wake up and you're getting messages. This currency is now illegal.
You're trying to trade. You have lots of cash in currency. You're trying to trade with it. You can't.
So they surprised the public. with it. So I didn't realize, but the impact it made. Now all the doctors are trying to get money. So they're at the bank. The lines at the bank are kilometers long, like people are going to vote. No one is in hospital. The nurses are there as well. And then the lines were only for citizens. There was no line for foreigners. So we didn't have money. We couldn't have money. We had some dollars, which now we would go and exchange with neighbors who you don't know. And of course, they're giving you shady deals. And we had to befriend some shopkeepers around us and say, you know, we live here in this house. We don't have money now. But when we get money, we'll pay you. Otherwise, we are going to starve. And so now we're in that mess, stuck in India, waiting for our operation date.
So how's your bro doing?
My bro and I, we were somehow making the best of the moments. So we had, what we would do for our pastime is in our, we were staying at Airbnbs. In our apartment, we would mimic what we went through during the checkup. So he would pretend to be a patient and
I'm the
role playing.
Yeah.
And we would have our mom record us. And so we would just joke about things.
That's nice.
Yeah, we would just joke about everything. And
it's a good way to handle stuff.
Yes.
Yeah?
Which has taken me far in life. And when the doctor finally called us and said, your surgery date is on this day, it was the 28th of November. And he says, your surgery date is 28th of November, 2016. And when he says that, I'm the only one who is like, yes, my parents, both of them, are now in a state of, I don't know if it's worry. I don't know. They are both shocked. And also my brother. My brother is also like, I can't believe the day is here. So on the surgery day, I remember first of all, you're in a room where they keep you together. So my mom is sitting with me on this side of the room, my brother and my dad on that side of the room, and there's like a divider, but we can open it. So me and my brother, we're talking the whole night because our surgery is like 8 a.m. So we're talking the whole night. We can't sleep. There's literally a nurse coming in, checking my vitals, giving me pills. I don't know what they are. I am the one being given a lot of stuff, you know, just different stuff happening. And then I think the funniest moment now was one nurse comes and, you know, not all of them speak English. So she's with a shaving. So she comes to me, she's like, you know, so my brother is looking at me like, where is she taking you? So she takes me to the bathroom. So you're shaved, right? You're shaved.
Completely.
Completely. There's no hair on you. And then they put like iodine on you. And so I walk out of the room and my brother asks me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how uncomfortable was it? And I'm like, 11.
11.
And he's like, and I'm next. I'm like, you can do this. So when they took us to the theater, they
You go both of you.
Yeah. You go both of you. And so there's like a prep room before you enter the main theater. So I rolled in. And I remember my brother, he's looking like he's panicking. He's worrying me. I am excited because I am like, this is what we have come for. Today's the day, you know, finally we can get over with this and we go home. And so I look at my brother and I tell him, the only thing I want you to do is accept my kidney. Accept it. Because there are transplants that happen and bodies reject. I'm like, accept it. I have given it to you. Please take it. And he looks at me and he's like, okay. And then at that point, they start giving you papers that basically you're signing and saying, if I die, I am here at my own will. So you're there signing your own death manenos. And so they roll me out and me, I'm excited. I am like this. I am waving to everybody. I'm waving to my mom. They're looking through a glass window. And I'm like, I will see you guys on the other side. And my brother is just like, he's looking at me like, I want to cancel this whole thing. And yeah, I wake up hours later, and my body feels like I have been run over by a bus. What a lot of people don't say is that the donor actually feels more pain than the recipient. Because your body wakes up and it actually recognizes one of us is missing. And so I could feel my whole body panic. Like I could feel my blood rushing, my brain wondering, where is it? Where is it? And at this point, I could feel like, you know, you're in theater, so it's ice cold. Mm. So I'm touching my hand. I'm literally feeling like my flesh is ice, like. Mm. And then I am
cold.
Mm. So I start shivering, like I'm shaking on this bed, like as I'm coming to. And I see my mom and I'm like, I'm cold. And so she covers me with a blanket and she's like, it went well. He accepted it. And I'm like, thank God. And so she walks out. Then my dad comes in and she's like, you know, I'm so proud of you. I love you. He's okay. And so I remember at this point where in the room that's, it's not really ICU, but it's still critical care. And I don't see my brother. My brother is in the HDU. Mm. He's in his own room, his own sort of space, mm. because his immunity is very low. Mm. So they have to minimize how many people.
Exposure. Mm.
So another thing people don't say is immediately after a transplant, I must walk. Mm. So I'm literally still bleeding mm. from stitches. I am feeling immense pain. Mm. And a nurse comes and she says, we have to walk. We have to walk, get up. And you're trying to, you feel like you have never walked in your mm. life. Like mm. your body is so heavy. And she's like, you must walk. And so it's also for your body to get used to
starting acclimatized.
This mm. new, this is the new normal. Mm. And your brain needs to start figuring yep. out, mm. this is how we are. This mm. is how we're gonna be. Mm. And so as I'm doing this walk and slowly walking, and my parents are there, and I say, I want to see him. I want to see my brother. So they're like, oh, wow, you're strong. Okay, it's on the other wing. So can you, will you in? Mm. So they take me on the bed. And so as far as the bed could reach his room, the bed can't. So they're like, do you want to step and see him? Mm. I'm not allowed to. No one was allowed to enter his room. Mm. Mm. So I'm like, yeah, let me go and see him. So I stand and I'm dragging myself with the doctor. And there's this small window. And my brother is in VIP. He's over there watching a movie. He's over there chilling. And so I knock on the window and I wave at him. And he looks at me like, he asks me,
how? Oh. Like, how are you on my window?
Oh. He's looking at me like, he's like, you're crazy. And then I'm so happy to see him. And I'm like, we did it. Oh. Yeah. So now he's okay.
You gave, he accepted.
He accepted. He's mm. had, I want to say my kidney, but he's had his kidney mm. now for 6 years. Mm. Yeah. He calls his kidney princess. And so we always joke because I'm always like, I'm sure your kidney is going through the first few months. It went through an environmental shock mm. because me, I was like, I am the drinker. I am always out. I eat whatever.
And him, he's on this other.
He's clean. He's water. He's healthy diet all the time. So we used to laugh. I'm like, I'm sure that kid has never seen so much water in its life. So yeah, he's fine.
Oh, that's I don't know. I don't know what to say. That is just amazing. And I've never had such a story before. And hearing it that way and you being that is. It's amazing, saving a life. And it makes sense then that these other things were not big priority. How was, you said you had begun dating mm-hmm. your now husband at the time. How is your relationship going with all this being away mm. and all what is you happening in your life? And then we'll come back now to see us at least.
You know, Billion, there's a night when we're in India. Mm. I was so frustrated with how we were stuck. And I was just like, I just want this to be over. So we were having, first of all, we were dating while I was in US. We actually.
So long distance?
Yeah. Billion, first of all, mm-hmm. we have different versions.
Of how you met.
Of how we met.
Yeah, that's true. That means you're supposed to be together.
Different versions. He seems to have seen me first, yeah. But I never noticed him.
Yeah.
But then, so that time when he saw me, he sent me a message in my DM on Facebook. And I never saw it because I was so busy, you know, with CSO plays and life. Who has time for men? Who has time? No time.
Yeah.
So now when I'm in US, now I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm not working on CSO plays, nothing.
Yeah.
So now that's when I started going through my Facebook messages.
You see this?
And then, then I say, oh, Billion messaged me like months ago. Mm. And so I finally respond. I'm like, hey, how are you? I'm actually not around. And so now talking to him, I was like, I thought you were just, you know, playing hard to get, you're ignoring me. Being a snob. Mm. But really, truly, that's when we started talking. Mm. And so when I told him I wasn't around, now that's when we started having calls and phone calls. And I actually began to know him when I was not in Kenya. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And so a lot of the beginning of our relationship
was virtual.
Mm. Yeah, because I was in Kenya, and then now telling him, hey, by the way, my brother's kidney failure, I'm trying to donate my kidney. I was like, it's a bit much.
This is so beautiful to hear. Also, given how you began this story with like your grandparents, and then your parents even how they came to meet, and then now you're meeting in a very virtual world, very different.
Very different. That's true.
Yeah, who'd have thought? You know, like the scenarios, the changes in the world are affecting even how people are relating.
That's so true.
And so when you're in India, you're still communicating, you're still with each other. How is he taking this?
He didn't know how to take it. Because many times I'd be on the phone with him and I would be venting about how, you know, I'm trying to be strong for my brother. This is really tough, but I, you know, we're going to get through this. And he would just be on the phone quiet.
So what do you say?
Yeah, he would not know what to say. Mm. And I think sometimes it's a good thing because he would just be present, which he continues to do to date. Because sometimes I don't want him to fix anything or to say anything. Mm. I just want him to listen.
Mm. Not to yourself.
Yeah.
Don't be a Mr. Fixer.
A way of fixing. I'm like,
let's sort it out.
Just listen. Yeah. So he has learned that skill from the get-go. Mm. And so I was actually meeting him really, truly. Like I met him in passing a few times. Mm. And one of the first times that I noticed him, I was leading a session. Mm. I was working for Search for Common Ground at the time. Mm. And it was a youth session. And so he walks in and he's late. Mm. He's late. Mm. And he's greeting people. I'm like, who is this popular guy interfering with my session? Mm. And so I just told him to please sit down, you know, and just not interfere with my session. Mm. And so he wondered, who is this chick who is so rude and also very direct? Mm. And so that's now one of the moments we began to talk. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Goes with you through, you have a very strong family just through that experience.
Yes.
And also a very good support system among each other, which is a big deal, which I mean, it's such a big deal. How does returning now to Siasa Place happen?
So after we get back, after the successful surgery, I'm really grateful because I had left the registration in the hands of Christine Dungu. So there was Dereba Mwangi, Mbuki Mburu. There are people who were still continuing with Siasa Place. Mm. And so at this point now, the registration hadn't happened yet, but I felt like I had more energy. Mm.
This is now 2016, 17?
Yeah, 2016. Mm. And so now I'm able to follow up with the processes and introducing the organization to different donors and doing activities. Mm. So now that I was present and fully engaged, a lot really happened, especially right into 2017. Mm. Because now I had trended once before because Bonnie had recorded me in a video saying something. Mm. Passionately at power. Mm-hmm. But then 2017 now was the first time I had been on TV. Mm. So now being on TV that now just catapulted me in so many levels. Yeah.
And that first experience on being on TV, what was it for? Like, were you going to speak on behalf of young people on an issue?
Yes. So remember I talked about enjoying writing and blogging?
Yeah.
So when I came back, I would write opinions for newspapers. They would never get published, but I would write religiously. And I would write on things that I felt that were important, especially to young people. And so one day I get a call from Teddy Otieno first. And he says, you know, Nirima, I just wanted to know about this Siasa place. We see your articles coming in and we find them very interesting here. We actually read them. So keep doing what you're doing. And then the next time I get a call, I get it now from Larry Mado. And at the time he had a show.
The Trend.
Yes. And so even before The Trend, because The Trend was on Fridays, he would do news. And so one night he asked me, you know, I would like to have you on the political segment after the news. Can you come? Can you come tonight? And so I just say yes. And, you know, I call my mom and I'm like, I accepted, but I don't know what I'm doing. Do I really know? And, you know, she's like, no, you've got this. You know this. And, you know, I call Kina Shefa and, you know, we begin to pray over the phone for wisdom and all that. But I didn't eat. I didn't eat. So I went, I looked for like a formal dress. And then that time my hair was orange and I had like a mohawk. So I'm like, there's nothing we can do about the hair. We just have to go
it's
as we
shock
are.
Notice and so yeah, let's do this.
So when I go to the studio and all that, there's like a lounge. There are two gentlemen. They're catching up. They seem to know each other. And I sit there and one of them, I find out, is a professor. And he says to me, young lady, you know, what are you here for? Unajua, tunaingia kuongea siasa. You know, we're about to talk about politics. And he says, this is not an entertainment show. And I don't say anything. I just look at him and I smile. And I keep quiet. And so they call us now into studio. So by then, his whole statement has completely disoriented. I know. I'm like, maybe he's right. Maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe I'm in the wrong place. So I remember walking in to the NTV studios and just seeing all the cameras and the people. And I'm just like, do I even know, you know, what I'm doing? And so when we sit there and, you know, they realize I'm on their panel, and you know, I just prayed because I couldn't eat because my stomach was so all over the place. I felt like if I ate, I would throw up on air. So I just said, you know what? Let's just go hungry. Hopefully it won't growl too loudly. And so after the interview started, I sort of relaxed and the rest is history. So that was one of the first interviews, and then I kept getting invited to more.
More and more as on TV, they won't call them a columnist, a panelist. So you had, when you had left, Siasa Place was still continuing. Do you find it difficult to rejoin when you come back? Are the structures established a lot more? Do you find your place nicely?
It was actually, when I came back, I was more disappointed on how not so much was done. Yeah, we were still stuck on trying to get the paperwork.
Startup mode.
Startup. And the back and forth, you know, with the board where they don't quite understand, you know, because the name Siasa was rejected three times.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I was being told, are you registering a political party? Are you trying to revolutionize the youth? And so there was a lot of tug and pull. And so I remember one day I call up the team and I say, I'm giving up. Like, I don't think we're going to be able to register this thing. And they refused me to give up. They're like, no, you can't give up. We've been pushing this too long. I mean, Boni was like, you need to sue already. And I remember just when I was like, okay, fine. I'll give it one more shot. The next day, we received an email that our certificate was ready.
Oh, okay.
the next day.
That was truly the 11th hour.
So, you know, that was now a peak for us to now be recognized. And I do remember that we didn't have a space to work from. So we were hosted by Heinrich Böll Foundation. So we worked there.
Somewhere in
Professor Wangari Maathai Road. So we were hosted there for a little while. Then we were hosted by Power 254 for a little while. So we were moving from offices until we finally got our own space, which was now 2017. That's now when we got our own office space, and that's where we are right now, though we're planning to move early on this year.
When you established, what key things or key programs were you seeking to do?
The main ones, we call it Siasa Talks, where we would meet with youth, like a town hall setup, just for them to get an understanding of, okay, what are your main issues?
Yeah.
And if they say it's garbage collection in my community, then who's in charge of garbage collection? How can we hold them accountable? And just those step-by-step processes and organizing young people, especially around the ward area, is what we started.
And that's the most important unit.
Yes.
Because that's where change happens the most.
Yes. And we've seen so much impact through those engagements that it's grown to where now we sit on advisory committees with Senate and even working with county assemblies specific to youth priorities and policies. And because we have that grassroots connection still. So we still feel and we still believe that youth groups, especially grassroots community groups, are the pillar of change in community.
Your 2017 year, did you... I remember you being part of G-Activate.
Yeah.
I think that's where I first knew of you.
Yeah.
Because then I was working at SIF and we were processing stuff for CSA, for G-Activate.
For G-Activate.
Which had you guys, it had, I think, Youth Clan and others. Yeah. What's your... I just want you to walk through maybe some of the key things. And you have begun by saying, you know, how some of the CSA talks and what they've contributed to, but the journey through, especially in programming.
I think I would say that it's being flexible because what we started is not what we are.
You've morphed.
We have morphed.
Yeah.
And that flexibility is super important because even when we came in with G-Activate, we were brand new in this space and G-Activate was one of the first to believe in our potentiality. And understanding that there are some people who are not good workers. So at that point is actually when Murabwa left, you know, because he was interested in vying for a position. And he ended up not vying, but he left the organization because he wanted to enter politics. And slightly later, Shefa Okore left as well, because now she ended up entering a different space, caring about women's rights movement space. And it's okay. So a lot of people were seasonal. And I think even when it came to programming, it was seeing that there are already existing youth groups and youth organizations and finding our niche. And our niche highly, highly, highly felt on the digitization of democracy. And so we find that right now we are a very strong youth organization that uses a lot of digital campaigns for their work and online social media movements and supporting groups to understand how to create a link between what you do on the ground and translating that virtually. So that definitely changed. So as much as we started with the forums, which were a place for awareness, getting to know the information, and then the next step is actualizing, you know? Once people have this information, how can you link them with a key champion?
Absolutely.
And how can they become a key champion? Even entering politics is the next phase that we rolled into. But I did recognize that I carried what I enjoy, which is writing. So we have a lot of writing programs in CSA Place. We try to create a space where we have young writers, and now it's evolved into cartoonists, spoken word artists, a way to express yourself. Because I felt that, you know, you can be young and you look a certain way, like maybe I look like someone who should be in entertainment industry or fashion. Mm. But no, I'm interested in discussing the politics of the world and governance and what climate justice means for us and the future.
Yeah.
And so it's just creating that space that's fluid and people don't feel judged that I have to belong in a certain community by the way I look.
And obviously with all of this comes many challenges. As you mentioned, you know, turnover, not necessarily of staff, but just even of like the founding team, the directors, resource constraints at times. What are some of the ones that have given you the most sleepless nights?
The most sleepless nights, I think you're so passionate about this idea. And there are people who look at you and they don't see it. Or people not really believing in you or banking on you. I think one of the toughest things I have seen is institutions that have been here for decades and the impact is so minimal. You can see where they're going wrong and you're like, I want to work with you. I want to help you because you are trusted, because you have the credibility due to experience and the years. So I found out that I was highly scrutinized because what do you know?
Yeah.
You're young. I mean, and then there was also the narrative of, of course, she comes from a well-off family. That's how she's made it. I mean, she was probably given that money by her uncle or something. So of course they created that for her to just do that on the side. So they don't believe in your hard work and discipline. And so I found myself being very tough. I am very tough on my team. I am tough. And it's because I realize that we are in a different field here.
Yeah.
We're in a different field. So how I am judged, you know, the way women are judged harshly. So now imagine being a young woman running an organization and then you're being
there's
given
association.
Yeah. Association because of my name and my upbringing. And then, of course, people are like, this girl, she doesn't know anything, you know? So it's just been handed to her. So people literally try to just make things hard for me just to prove a point. And so I think which I have been challenging, especially donor communities, is to open up. There are a lot of emerging, amazing ideas and platforms, but because people cannot associate with them or do not, they will not bank on them. And you'll find resources going to very old institutions that don't do much with it. And there's this comfortable sense of, I know this person. I've known them for years.
They've been bankable for many years.
For many years. So you don't even want to think starting something new will take too much energy and effort and work. And I don't want to do that work. So there's a laziness in terms of who is supported and who isn't.
It's interesting you mentioned being tough on your team for that because of understanding what's at stake. And also being tough, you know, like when you're calling out the ones with resources, how do you interpret the role of privilege? Just in, because you mentioned it a couple of times, at times just that name association can be positive. Then there's a time when it's like playing a backlash role.
I recognize that it's there. And we live in a country where unfortunately, names matter. And
names
pray,
betray you, like
I imagine.
The famous saying goes.
And I honestly do pray that my child will have a future where it doesn't. Because you don't choose where you get born. You don't choose what you get named. And so the fact that my mother grew up in a very political family, because her father was a minister, and so maternal. My mom joked once with me, she said, you know, after I grew up in a very political family, having my dad around so many politicians and growing up around politicians' children, I really wanted to marry someone who was far away from it. And then somehow,
lo and behold,
I know, I marry your dad, and then his brother becomes attorney general. It's like, how did this happen? And so now that I think about it, and now my husband in politics, I am pretty sure
this young man,
Ojiwa, our lives will be political as well. Mm. So it followed me.
Was that a discussion that you had with him, with your now husband, when you met?
Yes, we've had discussions because his grandfather was a chief. And, you know, growing up, I told you how I wasn't that open about my Wako name. And it's because of it brought attention that we didn't ask for. And sometimes you'd have people who would try and treat you different and you didn't want it. And then people who would automatically dislike you because of your name. And I just felt that as a child, it was just too much, too soon. And you know, I openly discussed that with my husband. And I say, you know, raising our son, I hope that he grows up in an environment that he has his own name.
Name and identity.
And identity.
So did that go into his naming?
Yes, it went into his naming. And in fact, even with his names, we're asked, his name sound Nigerian. Like he doesn't even sound
Kenyan.
Like he's from here. Because for us, we want him to build his own persona and not be sort of left to deal with what his parents have done and sort of carry on this pressure to carry on or this pressure of dealing with mistakes that your parents have made. But I do recognize that the privilege exists. And I think that's why for me, I intentionally choose to always recognize it. And even when we have our engagements, it's an understanding of where are we and who are we coordinating with and what is important for our people.
Yeah.
And even with my own team, I know that there are people who I see online, I get trolled a lot sometimes.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I see people, especially there's a comment that was on Facebook about this Nerima, ati she's helping grassroots. Does she know anything about it?
Sort of like first daughter.
Yeah. and I really laughed because I was like, if you saw the work that we do in the community, I probably know much more than you. But who is here measuring with a thermometer? It's fine. So people will always have their own opinions on things.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have this opinion because they don't know me.
Right.
They have personally never met me.
Yeah.
They don't know a thing about me. And they would be surprised that in my life, I do much more to help people around me than they do. And I do it because I want to do it.
Yeah.
And it's not something that I feel it's gets a reward or anything like that. Because this is a thankless job.
Yeah.
No one is going to come and tell you, thank you so much for holding the government accountable. Now I actually have water. No one is going to come and thank you. They'll just see their water and they'll be like, oh,
and
there's
tomorrow
water.
You have to wake up and think about another constituency member
exactly
who needs a particular change, and then you have to go and do the same cycle
again.
It's
a very thankless job.
Yeah.
So there's nothing I'm gaining from it. I'm here because I want to be here.
And so what's that then that keeps you going even when the trolling is happening, the challenges, at times resources? I don't know how COVID impacted on your work, but when all of these other things that could potentially derail are happening, what is it that keeps you going?
It's my faith. I'm very grounded in faith. And it's because I know I'm not answerable to man. And I know when my time is up, I have somebody that I have to answer to. And I feel what happened to my brother at such a young age also just showed me how life can be short because he got a second chance. And it's one of those things where we do not take for granted. So even with my brother or even my family, if we're with each other, we are with each other. And so I think for me, I just viewed life so differently. And even when I was driving yesterday, someone just swerved in front of me. And normally you would get road rage and be like, what are you doing? I just said, we pick a good fight. This is not it.
This is not it. They could be going through their own issues.
They are. This is not the fight. And so I think for me, my relationship with God keeps me so grounded. And I do understand that there is another life. And this life that I'm living is not mine. So even when we were blessed with a child, every day I pray that I raise this child how God wants me to raise this child, because he is not mine. And I'm grateful that God chose me to raise him. And so that's just how I view life.
That's really nice. And I want to get back into that family dynamic a little bit, family faith dynamic, but not before we wind up on Siasa Place. The question, two things I'm seeking to understand, and I know our viewers also would probably like to, is in this field, in the NGO CSO space, there is often a lot of misunderstanding from the public, often that you are in it because you're answering to a particular foreign agenda. You have foreign resources following you, and so it can limit, because the reality of it is that funding is never enough for just the kind of impact that we would like to be making. How has that whole aspect of looking for resources, doing grant making, allocating resources in a pool, or deciding to who will work in the team and stuff like that. How has that journey been for you? And now I think the person I'm thinking about, even as you answer this, is that leader, who an emerging leader who is starting up a grassroots focused piece of social impact organization, or someone who, because COVID has done its thing, is unable to like recover, or now because there's a lot of shift of donor resourcing, but also someone who is probably receiving the resources, but then the association again is that you're in this because of the money.
Yeah. First of all, it is so hard to start an organization.
Tell me about that. Yeah.
So even when I meet young people and they say, I want to be my own boss, I want to build a company, I look at them, I'm like, are you sure? Because I think we look at the success,
the end.
And you know, people don't know that in 3 years I didn't have a salary. In 3 years, we were literally, if a donor would support an activity,
activity. You're buying 6 sausages for 12 people. And
that's it.
And that's it.
So a lot of us relied on the transport, which we negotiated for.
And it's not a lot often.
It's not.
It's actually transport to get to you, and then
to the destination.
There's pocket change, maybe to have an ice cream.
Exactly. So I always tell young people that for me, leading an organization is one of the hardest things I've ever done. I sometimes wake up and wish I was an employee because I won't have to worry about getting salary, because now I worry about 12 people. I have a team of 12 and we work in 12 counties. And so if someone was to tell me that 5 years from now, your organization would be this big, and this is how much you'd be earning annually, I would say that's not true. That's a lie.
That's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So for me, I was really just looking at the impact I can make now around me. I wasn't even looking at the mountain. And so suddenly you wake up and you're like, oh, wow, I'm on a mountain. And even with leadership, I have had to call myself to several
Personal meetings. Hey, Nerima.
Hi. because I lost a social life when I started Siasa Place. I didn't have it. I've just told you, the only way I met my husband is because I had to leave to go to the US to go and watch and take care of my brother. And I had some downtime. If that didn't happen to my brother, I wouldn't have met my husband.
Interesting.
That is the truth. Because I was so focused on building Siasa Place that sometimes I would start my day as early as 7 a.m. And I'm here consulting for Search for Common Ground. And then I'm leaving at 3 p.m. To go to town to work on Siasa Place. And that means I was getting home at almost 11 p.m. So on weekends, when people are hanging out and going out, I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was writing articles.
Yeah.
I was writing concepts and sharing budgets. So I worked a lot. And even now I still do. I've just found a way to balance and put in time for family. But I think if it was about the money, I would have left a lot. Can be working for some major company, not even here.
Yeah, you had the education, you had the exposure, you had the name, like whatever.
I had it all. I could have picked to live in UK if I wanted to, or Japan.
You love it.
I love it. And I would probably be working on a job that gave me weekends off and
vacations
paid. And so I had access to that, and it's not what I'm passionate about. So I'm genuinely passionate about the work that I do. And I think that's the beginning. Once you're passionate, that fire, it keeps things going for you because you're just like, no, it's it's who I am. And it won't let you sit back. But I gave myself 3 years. I gave myself 3 years. I said, if Siasa Place doesn't get support in 3 years, if I can't build a team in 3 years, where not all of us are volunteering in 3 years, I have to call it quits. And it's the same advice I gave to Bina Maseno when she was starting Badili Africa. And she was sort of in the middle because, you know, you are interested in starting a business, but also here you're side hustling. So you're not giving it 100% sometimes. And I told her, you know, give Badili 3 years. If it doesn't launch, drop it.
Look at it now. We're glad we've had a conversation with her, and
it's grown.
And
so I did have to have that meeting with myself. But I think also something that I'm talented in is identifying the right people to work with me. Because you have to have a good team. And the people who are on my team, not all of them have gone to school. And I'll sit in an interview and I will know.
This is the person, this one is not.
I've been gifted.
What are the, because that's an X factor. So I know it's hard to pin it, but what, that's why you say at times, you know, what is it though that for you, you'll get?
I'll get. I genuinely look for what's passionate in a person. And I see if your passion matches with my passion. There's only one individual on my team who I hired, and he was in the wrong position. And there was so much back and forth. He was just not able to meet deadlines. He's struggling. And I saw he's super passionate with design and graphics. And we created a position. And now...
Reallocated and roles.
I said, look here. I went to the board. Said, look here. This guy, I don't want to let him go. He's really good at this. How about we create this position for him? And now, even as recently as yesterday, I had a whole other regional organization reach out to us and say, we want your graphics person. Can we partner and you guys do our graphics? And I was like, that's it. And so once you find what someone is passionate about, it's no longer about work. It's no longer about work. It's about now sharpening their skill. How can I be better at this? And now you are meeting at a point where you're both happy. And so for some people, it's money.
I like a better pay.
I like a better pay. So for me, for the people that I work with, I like to know what makes you tick. And I figure out how can we meet halfway with it.
We're living in a time of conversations around equity. And already I think by exhibiting that you can bring people in the team who would be otherwise not be employable for maybe education reasons or staff, that you're already creating room for equity. But what's your reflection around the whole, especially in this development sector of ours, what's your reflection around issues of diversity and inclusion, equity, belonging, how do you reflect on them? And beyond just your gender and beyond just your agenda in governance, what what's the role of it, and where are we in your, in from where, especially as a country, Kenya, where do you feel we are?
We have a long way to go as a country itself. But even within the work that we do, we do talk about diversity frequently and the intentionality of being diverse. So because politics, we find it's very male dominated, we intentionally say we need more women in this space. But even as recently as our last board meeting in the last quarter last year, we talked about what is diversity to us, which communities haven't we reached out to, and do we need to reach out to, and how do we reach out to. So even within the board itself, we have someone who, one of my board members, she's from the Nubian community. And she said, you guys did...
I married a Nubian queen, so I'm kidding.
And she was like, you see, you guys, last year, I, you know, I pushed the idea of working with the Nubian community, and you came in and you worked with us. You're one of the organizations that now you're recognized within our community. So let's do a step further. So we challenge ourselves to which community haven't we worked with that we need to. And I think even... when we talk about diversity, it's changing because of the access to technology. Because now we don't necessarily have to go physically to this community. And how is our content reaching communities? And how do we share this better? And how do we coordinate this better? So I would say it's always learning and going to the drawing board and seeing what are other people doing? What can I do better? And what is our niche? And we do not copy. I cannot look at someone else and say, I want to do what they're doing.
Duplicate,
I do not. Because I feel there's so much room.
For uniqueness and new things, new approaches.
Exactly. And there's enough. So why should I duplicate what somebody else is doing?
And so if you reflect back slightly before we move into now family, if you reflect back and identify what you are the most proud of for Siasa Place and for the work that you've done. And I was also curious which are the 12 counties and what's like the work, but maybe as you answer that, you can tell us what do you look back and commend yourself for and the team for achieving?
There are many, because we formed a youth serving organizations consortium now that has about 30 organizations and it's growing.
And not just 30 organizations in governance.
In everything.
Anything
that has to do with youth. So we have peace, agriculture, governance, education, health, everything. And it's still growing. And our newest members are from Isiolo. So to think that, you know, if we're in Isiolo, that means in the next year, hopefully we're across the whole country. And also we have sued government before and we have won. That was a big highlight.
What was the story?
It was an appointment under President Uhuru Kenyatta under the National Employment Authority. And he had appointed Mary Wambui Munene and we didn't feel that she was qualified because most youth are unemployed. And so we felt that it needed a chair that knew what they were doing. And so that is also a highlight for us.
And it's a change. And it matters a lot. Thank you for doing that.
It matters. And so we've also had several youth organizations being mentored by us and, you know, growing and attributing their foundation to our mentorship in Mombasa, in Kericho. We have formed networks that are now working with county assemblies. There are just so many things that has made me proud to be part of Siasa Place.
And you're closing in on hitting out of 35. How, when you look at the future of Siasa Place and your future, what do you see?
I don't see. And for me, that's the joy. What I'm working on is a space where young people belong and young people create.
Because
our slogan is inventing the future.
Right.
And so for me, it's not to create a predicted future. For me, is to create an environment that they're able to think outside the box.
Regardless of any scenario. Regardless. And what are the possible scenarios though?
A center. A center where people can really learn home and call home. They need to learn more. So that's what I see for Siasa Place. And that's why our new space has more space so that people can come, learn about history, learn about laws, learn about policies, and learn about how they can engage in their own communities, in their own everyday life.
And you serve and sit on and speak at various high level and events, and some of which are, and which one do you think, oh my God, about? You look back and you're like, oof.
I think so I'm currently on 4 boards. And I have not even counted. I sit on embassy advisory councils. But I think the big one for me was in 2022, last year, when I was appointed by the National Cohesion and Integration Commission to represent the youth on the NCIC, the Kenya Eminent Persons Panel.
Come on, come on.
Yo!
Kayamba, is this Kayamba, Kayamba?
That one, that one, because I was sitting on platforms of people that I've read about or, read about. Because we are not in the same space. And to sit in the same panel with generals to discuss the country and to discuss the piece of transition and what to do next. I think for me, I really appreciate Dr. Kobia to even appoint me in that board, in that commission. And even when we would have meetings, my voice mattered. It mattered. You can sit in task force panels and you're a token. But for me in that one, my voice mattered. It was, what do we need to do? What are your thoughts on this? Give us your opinion. And I had a lot of imposter syndrome.
Can you imagine?
A lot.
And it never quite stops.
It doesn't. But to be accepted by generals and judges and commissioners made me feel like, okay, I have something here. I think that was the one where I was
That's incredible. That's beautiful. In all of this, you also, it's not now a young family, but I remember, let me connect the parts. You met your boo online, and then there's everything that happened. And at what point now did you start forming a family? And who is he, and what would you like to talk about him?
So Billion Ojiwa, he has a center in Mathare, and also a politician. But then when we met, I met him at a government session that I was leading. He says he met me at one of Boni's functions at Power 254, but I didn't see him. He actually traced the picture and took a picture, and he drew where he was sitting and he circled to where I was sitting.
I believe him more. I believe his version more. Anytime.
I was there. I do not remember him at that meeting.
There is evidence.
I know. He has evidence.
Yeah.
But then now when I left for the US because of my brother, and then India. So we would talk virtually. Okay. So when I came back, when I came back, see, he's clever because when he sent me a message on Facebook, he didn't start off like, oh, I think I like you. Can we talk? Can we hang? No. He sent me a documentary that featured him.
Oh, come on.
Clever. So he's like, oh, there's a documentary about me that's come out. It's just come out. And I would like to hear your opinion on it since you have a background in communications. I said, okay.
Yes. Slide that in very easy.
I know. Yeah. So me, I'm over here. I'm thinking it's work. Okay, I can do this. And so we started talking from there. It was after his documentary and just giving him feedback on it. Now we started talking. And so when I came back, to Kenya. I met him for the first time now face to face. And the interesting thing about Billion is he showed me who he was from the get-go. And so here I am. I've always grown up on Ngong Road and never really left Kilimani area. And he's like, I want to show you where I live. And we went to, he lived near, what's the name of the room? Maziwa. Maziwa, okay. Near
Embakasi, those sides?
Yeah.
No?
Not really Embakasi, no. It's near, there's a very famous estate there. It's like Kamiti Road.
Okay.
I've forgotten the name of that estate. Mm-hmm. It's on the other side. Me, I had never been on that side of Maziwa. And so he shows me, you know, this is where I live. And I have a center in Mathare. He showed me center.
You went to Mathare, so?
That was my first time in Mathare. And I also brought my family to Mathare for the first time. That is a whole other experience.
I can imagine.
My parents are like, what are we doing? Anyway.
Really? They were afraid? And
they were just like, what is this? What world is this? Like, my dad was like, you do not know this world. Because Billion took me to a kibanda.
Yeah.
That was my first time.
Oh, come on. I like
it. So, we had lunch in a kibanda. He was like, this is who I am. You know, this is what I'm about.
To see Danganyane, was it?
I know. And I'm not going to try and show you a life that I'm not about.
Yeah.
And I remember he had a Toyota then, which looked like it was on the verge of breaking down.
Every day.
I know. Because he came and picked me up in it. And so...
At least he was driving, but now
he was driving.
Gear Mat 46.
I know, he was driving.
Yeah.
And so, and that's how we started to get to know each other. So I think the beginning with Billion was very serious and straight to the point. And I think it's because of the virtual conversations that we had.
Yeah.
So we knew a lot about each other before meeting. And he was very clear that me, I'm looking to start a family. I'm not playing around. I'm not beating around the bush. So we kept our relationship very private. People didn't know we were dating. We didn't have any images, any trace of it. Even to date, you can't find, we've put our relationship like married to each other on Facebook.
Yeah.
It's not there. And so we would put pictures of each other sometimes. Unless you know us, you know we're together. And so the reason for all of that, it's so funny because I told you my first time on TV, I was interviewed by Larry Madow. Larry Madow and my husband are very good friends. They're like most best friends. So anytime he's in the country, he goes
they
and
hang out.
They hang out. And so when Larry found out that we're engaged, he could not believe it.
How is this happening?
How? He's like, how? And
the two most unlikely people to be together.
Yeah. He's like, you mean I know you both? Yeah. Like in different spaces.
Yeah.
So it's something that we continue to date where we intentionally keep our relationship. We try to, because there's one point, it, but we try to keep our relationship as private as possible because we feel if you feed the public about your relationship, they will always want more.
And then it's more bad.
They're not interested in your relationship. They're interested in the negative of your relationship.
Yeah.
And so we're like, why begin to show you in the first place? And so that's something that we've always done. But I remember that after we got married, the choice of where to live was such a huge conversation.
Yeah. Imagine.
Yeah, so I moved to Maziwa. We stayed there for maybe 6 months. And by then, I don't have a car. I'm using a mat. And sometimes Billion would drop me and all that. And I remember my parents having a conversation with me and they say, you know what? It's good that you're starting together and building together. And I hope that you have a life that he can take care of you. And I hope that you won't put pressure on him to give you a life that you're used to. I hope you will have the patience for him to grow to that. And I do hope that we've raised you in a way that you bring that same stability for your child. Yeah. And so our next apartment, because I got frustrated with Maziwa, the truth, because of the distance, and I was working in town, and it was just like the neighborhood, I didn't know it. And I was like, I'm not used to living in apartments with many people, and I grew up in a house, very quiet. And so I was like, what is halfway? So halfway for us, which was a fight, we moved to a very small one bedroom in Parklands. And I remember him saying, I don't know if I'm ready for Parklands. And me being, no, we are. We'll work on it together. We'll do this together. We lived in Parklands for 1 year. And we now moved again to Ruaka. Now Ruaka, we were both like,
we are okay.
We are okay.
Yeah.
Because it was a mix of both worlds for us. And for me, that was a huge lesson on marriage, on our marriage, and just finding the compromise, because it's a lot about compromise.
Yeah.
And where we are both comfortable.
Yeah.
And us not feeling that we have to be keeping up with appearances and keeping up with a lifestyle that we're not ready for. And out of that, now we've been married 5 years, it's going on six. Now we've bought land, we've built, we're now in a place where we're like, we're okay.
And as your folks said, you've worked on it together. You've been patient with each other to work towards that. That's a, I mean, that's, I'm married 13 years now, I guess, or something. I lose track. But that's a huge lesson that you only learn at times much later. Especially for, and I commend him too, I commend you a lot, you know, for choosing to sort of, you know, say, I'll come to where, you know, we can start together. And I commend him for identifying up. Marrying up it's work.
It's work.
Yeah, it's work, but it's beautiful at the end when
I love it so much. I love it.
And how do you find, you mentioned it earlier that you try to find, to schedule your day and time. To ensure that there's time for family, both your nuclear now and also the family you come from. What goes into that for you with the kind of work that you're doing, with the kinds of demands, and then the fact that you say he's also a politician and running for office in perhaps, you know, where he need to be is a lot more different from what you would, you know, like ordinarily be doing. So there's a lot going on in both your lives. You have a young baby. How does, what factors into all of this for you? And into all of this for balance for you guys?
Yeah, it's the fact that organized helps a lot. And I also have a really good support system. Like even when I knew when my son was old enough for us to have a nanny, I knew that the kind of nanny I have to have is someone who is also organized like me. If we go off schedule,
It will be crazy.
It's crazy. And this is the reason why. The good thing is we don't have a TV at home. And it also minimizes because we have a deal that when our son is in front of us, our phones are away. So it's interaction. So we understand that when we have short time with him, it's intense. It's intense time with my child. And it's the eye contact. I'm with you. We're interacting. I'm playing with you. I'm singing. So we have a lot of singing in our house because we depend on the radio. And so we have a lot of interaction and conversation.
This was a conscious decision to actually, because I remember Bina was mentioning it, to actually plug out the
TV. We have no TV.
It's but you plugged it out. Like
It's in a box. We have no TV. And if we do want screen time, it's our own screen time. And it's because I have things that I enjoy. Like, you look at us, you would think, who is action, it's me. So the things that I want to watch, and him is on football. So we have our own screen time that we feel, okay, this is my individual time. And so my days start very early. In our house, even my son, he's up by sometimes 5:30, sometimes 6 a.m.
And he's only two?
He's two.
Wow.
Yeah. So the whole house, we are very
early risers.
And I know, like, I really try to start with meditation and prayer to just center myself before the rat race. And after about 30 minutes, an hour of that, I now spend it with my son. So I have very early morning playtime, catch-ups with him when he wakes up. Then now I go to work like from 7. And so when I come back home, I try to come back home early because I know that our son sleeps early. He's in bed by 8. So we both try to rush home before 8.
That's really good.
So that we can spend even, because he has dinner at 7, so that we can spend 7 to 8 just now interacting.
Winding down the day.
Yes, because I realize that there are parents who might be home with their children, but they are not home.
Yeah, you're there the whole day, but hey.
They're not home. They're not home. And we recognize the intentionality of time because, like, Sunday is our day. In fact, you know, Billion says Sunday is family day. So after church, we go swimming, we walk in the park, we hang out. And so, because we also feel that Sunday is the only day that I can breathe and he can breathe. As a politician, he might have to go for a church service, but the afternoon is free. So I think because I recognize that my time is limited, I also do things immediately if I can. And so I'm in chamas, I'm in Sijui, different life groups with church. And so, especially my chama, I'm always somehow a secretary or I'll be the chair lady. So if we have a meeting, if there are minutes, I will do the minutes then and there. So the way I try and schedule my time is, especially like in the office, my team knows I don't like walk-ins. Because you have interrupted with my flow. Like, I rather have like a day.
A schedule.
Yeah. Tuesday, you walk in. Tuesdays, I'll do the walk in. I will greet you. I'll say hello to you. I'll hang out with you. But Mondays, I can't because it's catch up. So even my team, they're like, oh no, a walk in. Maybe you come tomorrow. Just come back tomorrow. She'll be here and she'll be fully with you. But today, she has to do catch ups. So I really try and do that, but because I have a really supportive nanny, she's been
same from the past that you got.
Yes, the same. And you know, we've worked together. She's understood how I am, and so we have been together since my son was 2 months. And so my son, his diet or our diet, it's a very clear schedule, and this helps because if I'm shopping, it's one time, and for the week, I am not wasting time on what's for dinner, tunapika nini, ulinunua nini. That wastes so much time, especially for women who lead organizations, because you are literally leading the home as well and managing home. And so that has cut out a lot of time for me. So if she's going to call me, I'll call her maybe midday to find out how my son is doing. But I know he's out, he's in the sun right now, he's in playgroup right now, he's like, I know his schedule, and so she's also very secure on what his schedule
that's really good
looks like.
My wife calls a good nanny her wife. She says, yeah, Max, you need to get me a good wife.
Because it's true.
I mean, to be balanced that way, you require as you say, like an extremely good level of organization.
Yes.
Because then, you know, Riwa would be wondering how things are. So you're functioning, you then are able to function better as a wife.
Yes.
And better also as a mother.
As a mother.
And whatever other things that you do in life.
Yeah, because even with the schedule, like a lot of people are like, oh, that's so strict, why on a schedule? Children actually like schedules.
They do.
because they know what's happening next.
Yeah. Oh, randomness know, oh, with children is should be oh, the exception, oh, not the norm.
Yeah, yeah. They like schedules. Yeah. And because he sleeps at 8, mm. I can now use
they probably
the
may
rest.
Not even like they need.
They need
and
it.
And at times it's not about them liking.
Yeah,
it's,
they need
What human being will you be? So like, get organized. You
yeah.
go to, if there wasn't such kind of, I mean, you are able to leave the country young.
Yes.
If there wasn't like, you know, a proper planning, it would have been very difficult for you
I wouldn't
to,
have managed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to graduate.
Mm, exactly.
I wouldn't. And so because he sleeps early, I also have a lot of free time.
Yeah.
Because I sleep around 11.
Mm.
So now I can choose, do I want to read a book?
Yeah.
Do I want to catch up on some work?
Mm.
Do I want to watch a movie?
Mm.
And so that helps me rest.
Yeah.
And then I really, really, really try not to work on weekends.
Mm.
So I don't bother my team unless it's necessary.
Mm.
And they don't bother me unless it's necessary.
Mm.
So the weekends are locked.
Yeah.
And so that's now when I will try and check up on friends, check up on my brother, hang out with him, or do the things that I find fun to do.
Yeah.
But if I wasn't organized, I wouldn't be able to manage.
Mm.
And my sister, she's always said, you can't have it all.
Yeah.
You can't.
Mm.
And so I can't be the present mother that I wish to be.
Mm.
That I'm there with you all the time, every day, because I am working.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we already know, like me and my sister and how we've been raised, you can't have it all, but you can balance.
You can do the best.
You can do the best.
With what life has dealt you.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, listening to you is very inspirational. And I'm here thinking, I hats off to you for leading young, for taking it all, taking what life has dealt you, taking it and making beautiful out of it. Earlier on when you were catching up off camera, you said, you know, like you choose your battles in a very, you're like, how is this going to be? It will be a good day. How is this year going to be? There are many things that are happening. It's going to be a good year. Just the positivity that you carry and that you inspire, the both at a family level, at a health level, you know, mental, physical, at you know, leadership level in your organization, it purely is inspirational. And thank you for sharing your journey with us. I'll give you the honors to close it up for us, but I just want to say, even with the work that you're doing with Siasa Place and the fact that, you know, you're creating futures, futures that we all can walk in, futures that our children in a very fast-moving world can walk into and find a sense of security and stability, development challenges that are not the same that you are dealing with, maybe that are for their time, but also consciously creating a better world out there, but also consciously creating a better world and a better child to thrive in that. That's a really important thing. And I'm grateful to just have sat here and been a listener to this. And so I don't know what you'd like to say as your concluding remarks, but it is with you. And thank you for joining Development Dynamics with Maxi.
Thanks, Maxi. Mm. I think for me, it's thank you for encouraging me to do this. I normally don't share about me. And I'm normally the person who takes care of things and people around me. So it's a learning process for me.
Mm.
And you've opened up that side to me and I appreciate it.
Write your book.
I appreciate it.
Mm.
But also, I also appreciate, you know, even people like you, where how I view life, it's like a tapestry, right? Like, so there are so many different strings that have different colors. And so we don't see the entire design, but you as a string, me as a string, we make an impact on the overall design.
Yeah.
And I feel sometimes in life, especially, you know, if we are to look at people who are leaders, if we are to compare them to like a mountain, right? They're at the peak. So oftentimes we focus on the peak. Like even when we look at Mount Kenya, we're looking at the snow at the peak and people want to embark it and climb to the top of it. But we forget that that peak wouldn't exist without the rock that makes the base. Mm. And for me, I really appreciate the people and the teams and a lot of support systems around us that forms the base. Mm. And sometimes people don't even realize they are a base for you. Mm. And it's recognizing that the base is as important as the peak, because without the peak would not exist.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah. Your work, I love that it's magnifying that.
Mm.
And mm. I've really enjoyed having this conversation.
And I'm hopeful that in 3, 4 years, 8 years, whenever next, we can see it and add on to the
Amen.
Reflections with greater insights and with time. For as long as I can continue to do this, this is my passion project.
Yeah.
I love it. I get inspired. I learn a lot. I get to reflect. And so thank you for honoring us once again. And we're out.